Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Book Network's page for Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Patrick Slaney. Today I'm talking to David Sapkowski about his new book, Rereading the Fossil Record, The Growth of Paleobiology as an Evolutionary Discipline. In the book, Sapkowski tells a story that explains the many ways that paleontologists have interpreted the meaning and importance of fossils in the light of evolutionary theory. Starting with Darwin and his own dilemma concerning the fossil record, Sapkowski traces the relationships between paleontology and evolutionary theory over the course of the 20th century. As it was formulated in the mid-century, the evolutionary synthesis did not really allow paleontology to contribute to evolutionary theory, and it fell to a self-consciously revolutionary generation of paleontologists in the 1970s to argue that reading the fossil record could change the theory of evolution. Drawing on increasingly sophisticated ways of modeling and simulating evolutionary processes, as well as increasingly available computational power, paleobiologists built institutions and articulated ideas, such as punctuated equilibria, mass extinction, and macroevolution, that demonstrated how the history of life revealed by reading the fossil record needs to be incorporated into evolutionary theory. Hi, David.
Hi, Patrick.
Welcome to the New Book Network's page for Science, Technology, and Society.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're talking today about your new book, Reading the Fossil Record, The Growth of Paleobiology as an Evolutionary Discipline. But before we jump into it, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Sure. Well, it's kind of a little bit of a convoluted story. I'll keep it short here. But I actually trained as a historian of early modern mathematics back in the late 1990s at the University of Minnesota in the History of Science and Technology program there. And my father was a paleobiologist, and in fact, Jack Sapkowski is one of the characters in this book. And I really had no interest in writing, writing a book or doing any work on the history of modern paleontology or biology, really until I finished up my PhD at Minnesota, which was on 17th century mathematics. And my father died in 1999, and in the process of helping an archivist at the American Philosophical Society collect his papers to be deposited there, I just started reading things. You know, I'm a historian, and that's what we do when we've got a bunch of letters and manuscripts in front of us. I started looking at things as I was putting them into boxes, and I realized, wow, there's some really interesting stuff here. There was correspondence with people like Stephen Jay Gould, and it seemed like the period of time when my dad had been active in the 1970s and 1980s especially was just a really fascinating and exciting time in paleontology. And so I thought, well, you know, there's at least a paper here. And I had a postdoc at the time at Oberlin College. And so I was sort of thinking about what my next project would be, and I had a little time. And so I wrote a paper about this era, the 1970s in paleobiology, when people like Stephen Jay Gould really advocated very strongly for paleontology to be a kind of independent evolutionary discipline. And I had so much fun writing that paper, I decided to write a book and basically gave up being an early modernist and became full-time historian of modern biology and paleontology. Really kind of a transition in my intellectual career, but one that's really brought me a lot of pleasure. It's been a lot of fun working on this stuff.
Okay, so Did you do a lot of Latin, at least as an early modern mathematician?
Yeah. I had to do all that stuff. And, you know, it's fun and I still love the early modern period. I mean, yeah. I still read the literature and I love teaching scientific revolution and things like that. One could say that was all for naught because I use most of that training in what I do now, although it probably informs me somewhere in the background. Yeah.
Although I was going to say that at least it's not entirely for naught, because at least there's still, you know, some Latin in paleontology.
Well, they're right, exactly. Yeah. The taxonomic names.
Yeah, exactly. The book is mostly about the 1970s, but you kind of argue that, in order to understand the relationship between evolutionary thinking and paleontology, you need to go back to Darwin. So can you say a little bit about how Darwin thinks about fossils and what sort of the legacy of that is?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, and of course, you know, fossils are crucially important for evolutionary theory, and they were very, very important to Darwin. Fossils had first really begun to be seen as biologically significant entities in the era of geology before Darwin. So in the 1820s, 1830s, fossils are being primarily used as markers for stratigraphy, you know, as markers to tell us, relatively speaking, how old different layers of the Earth are. But beginning in the 1830s and 1840s, especially in Germany and France and England, geologists began to take fossils seriously as telling us something about the history of life and perhaps something about the directionality in the history of life. Although, of course, for most scientists, not as indications of evolution. And Darwin, during his Beagle voyage and afterwards, took a great interest in fossils. And I think it's fair to say that they were, you know, crucial pieces of evidence in convincing him of the reality of descent with modification and evolution. So they're the physical evidence that tells Darwin that evolution has taken place. But the kind of the interesting paradox, which is one of the hinges on which my book turns, is that despite the fact that Darwin recognized fossils as being tremendously important for establishing the reality of evolution, he didn't really believe that the fossil record was complete enough for paleontology to make much of an independent contribution to evolutionary theory. So he thought that there were too many gaps, too much incompleteness. Darwin, of course, has a whole chapter in the Origin of Species about the imperfection of the geological record, where he sort of apologizes for it. He says, well, you know, if we had a perfect fossil record, we would see this gradual succession of forms from the, you know, very first organisms up to the present, but we don't. So the best that we can do is look to those particular cases where we do have a complete succession, but don't expect to find, transitional forms throughout the fossil record. And as I argue, at least, this was a kind of pessimistic diagnosis for the development of modern paleontology. You know, paleontology is told basically that, you know, it's capable of presenting interesting examples of evolutionary succession, but it won't have much to say on its own. And certainly by the early part of the 20th century and up into the modern evolutionary synthesis, paleontologists were really kind of relegated to a backseat role when it came to discussions of evolutionary theory. And, you know, in part, I lay that blame, if you want to say blame, right at Darwin's door.
Okay. So does anything change by the evolutionary synthesis? What's the relationship with sort of, it's a major change in the way that people think about evolution. Does it change the way that people think about the relationship between evolutionary theory and paleontology at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to point out that despite the fact that kind of mainstream biology took a fairly dim view of the contribution that paleontology could make to evolutionary thought, paleontologists themselves from the period after Darwin, from the 1880s, 1890s, up through the 1930s and 40s, were making statements about evolution on fossils. It's just that their their statements about evolution weren't really being heard or taken very seriously by the developed profession of modern evolutionary biology. And part of the problem there is that many of these paleontologists favored non-Darwinian mechanisms, things like Lamarckian evolution or orthogenesis, and that kind of kept them marginal in the community of evolutionary biology. But by the 1930s and 1940s, I think two things had happened. The first was that more fossils had been collected. So, the more fossils you collect, the more complete your record is going to be, and the more you're going to be able to say, or at least the more confidence you're going to have about what you can say about evolution based on the fossil record. And then the second thing was that there were some important pioneering paleontologists, both in Europe and in the United States. In Europe, people like the Austrian paleontologist Othene Abel, and in the United States, of course, George Gaylord Simpson, who really made a strong commitment to have dialogue with biologists and to trying to really incorporate their work into some of the exciting developments that were going on in genetics and other areas of biology that were leading to the modern synthesis.
So how did Simpson in particular think about the possible contribution of paleontology to evolutionary understanding?
Well, yeah, I think Simpson, Simpson's probably the most important figure in the history of in the 20th century history of evolutionary paleontology, because he's the one who really gets the ball rolling. He was one of the first people to begin to refer to what he was doing as paleobiology, which he didn't invent. It had been used by some of those German paleontologists earlier in the century. But Simpson was also one of the only people that read in the United States or in the Anglo-American paleontological community who read paleontology. And so he picked up a lot of ideas from the Germans. And Simpson really, it was in part because of his position at the American Museum of Natural History. He ended up having colleagues like Ernst Mayr and Theodosius Dobzhansky, and he got to know these people personally because the AMNH is affiliated with Columbia University, where both Jansky and Mayr, passed through at various points in their career. And so he got to know these people personally. And he also, I think he just personally had ambitions for himself and for the field. He didn't want paleontologists were doing to be marginalized in journals that were read only by paleontologists. He really wanted biologists to take the work seriously. And so he was committed reaching out to biologists, to incorporating biological contributions to evolutionary theory into paleontology, but also to begin to use some of the texts that biologists were using at the time, so to make paleontology more quantitative and to begin exploring what one could do with more sophisticated mathematics and even modeling in applying analysis to the history of the fossil record.
Okay. And actually, this theme of sort of the need to build institutions is something that I think you developed really well through the book, and we can return to a little bit. Did Simpson train graduate students? I mean, that's one way of institutional building.
He didn't have a lot of graduate students, but curators at the American Museum could be on dissertation committees at Columbia and indeed could. And Simpson did direct a few graduate theses, although he didn't do a lot. He was not, I don't think, deeply committed as a teacher. I think he saw his role more as a researcher. One of Simpson's students was the very eclectic evolutionary biologist Lee Van Valen, who passed away a couple of years ago, was a longtime professor at the University of Chicago. And Van Valen actually shared Simpson and Dobzhansky as his mentors. So, I mean, there's a great example of, direct through teaching and directing graduate work, how Simpson was integrating what he was doing with what obviously one of the most important biologists of the synthesis was doing. You know, he had a more indirect influence, I think, on the generation of paleontologists who were coming up, especially in the 1960s, all of whom read his books. I mean, that was required reading, really, for young paleontologists in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And so I'd say he had a profound influence on young paleontologists, but in a more indirect sense.
Okay. So the other pioneering sort of paleontologist in this time period that you think is really influential is Norman Newell. How did he contribute to the growth of paleobiology?
Newell was really very much kind of Simpson's partner in this enterprise of bringing paleontology into evolutionary biology, especially in the 1950s and 1960s. Simpson's a vertebrate paleontologist, so was working with was from the vertebrate fossil record, of course, vertebrate fossils are far.
Hey, David, welcome back. Sorry about that interruption.
Oh, no problem at all.
Okay. Before we left or were interrupted, you were talking about Norman Newell and his kind of broader significance in the story.
Sure. Yeah. And what I was saying is that Newell and Simpson really kind of need to be seen as a team in this earlier period of the establishment of paleobiology in the middle of the 20th century. Simpson was a vertebrate paleontologist. So the fossil record that Simpson was studying was, of course, the vertebrate fossil record. And one of the issues between vertebrate and invertebrate paleontology is that there are a lot more invertebrate fossils. So, you know, just think about all the tiny little shells that you see, let's say, in limestone or something like that. I mean, there are orders of magnitude more invertebrate remains than vertebrate remains. It takes kind of a lot, actually, for a large animal to get fossilized and preserved. So what Simpson was trying to do was very ambitious, but his own research wasn't necessarily the best, didn't necessarily provide the best empirical evidence to fully document the history of life. And Simpson thought it was very important to recruit an invertebrate paleontologist into the American Museum and into sort of the kind of proto-movement that he was beginning. So Simpson directly hired Norman Newell in the 1940s, shortly after the Second World War, and brought Newell to the museum as a young paleontologist. And Newell really, I think, developed under Simpson's wing in a lot of ways in the first 5 or 10 years that he was there. And ultimately what Newell did was essentially to carry on the kind of work Simpson was doing, and that is work that was quantitative and theoretical and which was geared towards reconstructing large-scale patterns in the history of life, only Newell was doing it with invertebrate fossils. And for this reason, in many respects, I would say that the Newell was just as important, if not even more important than Simpson, to later generations of paleobiologists who really would focus predominantly on the invertebrate fossil record. So the kind of work that Newell was doing, documenting large-scale patterns of evolutionary change in the marine fossil record, in marine fossils, was exactly what was continued in the 1970s and 1980s in the later chapters that I describe in my book, when paleobiology really goes through a kind of revolutionary phase. And Newell also trained more students than Simpson did, and some of the students that he trained went on really to be the leaders in this next generation, probably the two most prominent being Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge, who together were the people that came up with the theory of punctuated equilibria.
Right. Let me ask you a question about them. So, I mean, I think we often think about biology as a discipline that's supposed to take time and history seriously.
Right.
And I guess I'm wondering about Simpson and Newell. Did they want to sort of incorporate paleontology with biology because they just thought that biology was cool, or did they think that paleontology had something, I guess, important to contribute about the history of life to the understanding of evolution?
Sure. Simpson's first book, which is considered still by many to be his most important contribution, Tempo and Mode in Evolution, which was published in 1945 in the famous Columbia University Press biology series that also had Dobzhansky's Genetics in the Origin of Species and Myers' Systematic in the Origin of Species and other important books, made the case that paleontology offers a fourth dimension to evolutionary biology, and that fourth dimension is time. So the answer to your question is that Simpson absolutely thought that time was the, you know, significant dimension that paleontology could add, and that it added a perspective to evolutionary biology that was simply not there otherwise. So paleontology wasn't just adding something interesting. That this synthesis of paleontology and biology wasn't just a good idea for institutional purposes or something like that, but rather that paleontology offered something vital, crucial, and missing to the story of the history of life.
Okay. Do biologists agree with them?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a good question, and that's the that's kind of the $64,000 question throughout the history that I'm describing in my book. And the answer to that is that some did and some didn't. And it was complicated and contested along the way. Simpson, of course, is considered one of the architects of the modern evolutionary synthesis, along with Meyer and Dobzhansky. And he was very much an equal partner in terms of the organizational role that he played in, say, establishing the Society for the Study of Evolution, founding the journal Evolution, and kind of organizing the agenda of the modern synthesis. Meyer and Dobzhansky and other major framers of the modern synthesis, Sewell Wright and others, certainly respected him as a scientist. How much, though, did they accept the kind of the theoretical intervention that he was trying to make is another story together. And what you see is that, you know, in some cases and at some times, biologists were quite receptive to what people like Simpson had to say. But there was a constant pushback also from the biologists that goes from the 1940s all the way, I'd say even up to the present, in being somewhat uncomfortable with the notion that paleontology has something autonomous, say, about evolutionary history. And particularly, I think, there's a deep-seated skepticism or mistrust among biologists that perhaps what paleontologists are really trying to say is that there are different evolutionary mechanisms in operation that paleontology has access to. And there's some, I think, nervousness that paleontologists are actually trying to talk about evolutionary mechanisms that are different from the ones that geneticists or other biologists study. And so that back forth has really characterized the history of the relationship between paleontology and biology over the last 50, 60, 70 years.
Okay. And we'll get there in particular. But maybe before we get to the sort of the revolutionary characters themselves, I mean, the other thing that turns out to be very, very important is really just the sophisticated modeling that the self-declared paleobiologists of the 1970s bring to the table. And you sort of talk about how in the 50s and 60s there's a growth of techniques for mathematically modeling biological phenomena,
right.
Things like morphometrics and theoretical morphology and island biogeography and paleoecology. How do those? I mean, what are they doing that's new, and how does that knowledge make its way into paleobiology?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the I think really interesting characteristics of this paleobiology movement is the extent to which paleobiologists were borrowing ideas, models, techniques, methods from other disciplines. And you know, say, island biogeography, which develops independently in the 1960s, is crucially important to paleobiology, but it's, you know, it's not a theory from paleontology. You know, in some cases, these approaches were really new and original. So thinking about, say, assemblages of fossils as communities in paleoecology is a really new way of thinking about the history of life, and that's something that develops in the 1950s and 1960s. Theoretical morphology, which is an approach to understanding the kind of mathematical relationships that govern the formal characteristics of organisms, say the relationship between the height and the width of a shell or something like that. That's actually a very old field, an old tradition that goes back into the 19th century. In the hands of paleontologists in the 1960s, especially, and here the paleontologist David Raup, who had a long career at the University of Chicago, was one of the real movers, were able to adapt new technologies, computers, most prominently, to the study of old questions. So, for example, it had been known for a long time that there are particular equations that govern the ideal shape of certain kinds of shells. And those equations were from the 1840s. But what Raup was able to do was put those equations into a computer and produce these wonderful simulations of ideal shell types. And so it's an interesting marriage of old ideas and new technologies that kind of help produce this new approach to the study of the fossil record using in some cases simulations rather than relying just on the fossils that were being dug up out of the ground.
Okay. And so it's just that Raup learns this and then he trains people and realizes that it has significance?
Yeah. I mean, okay. You know, Raup kind of falls into this accidentally. He was trained as a fairly straightforward invertebrate paleontologist. He worked at Harvard under Bernard Kummel, who was a longtime Harvard professor, who actually was Norman Newell's first student. But Raup was trained in fairly traditional approaches to invertebrate paleontology, and he kind of happened on computers accidentally. And I think that, Raup was always interested in iconoclastic ideas. He was always the person who wanted to ask the question that would potentially upset the conventional wisdom. I think that Raup was always just kind of pursuing the interesting questions that popped into his head without really thinking about launching a movement. And the students that Raup trained were kind of an eclectic group of people. But Raup tended to just always, for some reason, to have his kind of finger on the pulse of what was new and interesting in the field. So in the 1960s, it was this theoretical morphology, which was a kind of a rekindling of interest in the mathematical study of, as I said, the kind of formal properties or characteristics of biological forms. And this is something that goes back to Darcy Wentworth Thompson in the early 20th century. And Raup spent several years making these pretty computer model shells, and then kind of lost interest in that and moved on to something else. And that was typical of Raup's career. He'd work on something for several years, and then he'd find something else that was interesting and kind of drop what he'd been working on before. Raup, as opposed to some of the other people that we'll be talking about later, I don't think was really committed so much to movement building as it was to just asking questions that had asked before. for, looking at things in a new perspective.
Okay. He certainly has a long and really dynamic career that remains relevant all the way, I think, to the end of his research life, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you use this phrase about people concerned to launch a movement, and several of the characters, I mean, the important characters associated with paleobiology in the 1970s, self-consciously think about themselves as revolutionaries, and, you know, right. Some of them have read Kuhn, and they, you know, seem to think about science in those exact terms.
Yeah.
What exactly is it that they're revolting against?
Sure. Well, you know, some of it is just a continuation of what people like Simpson and Newell were themselves rebelling against, although I don't think that either Simpson or Newell would have thought of himself as a revolutionary. You know, just this idea that, you know, paleontology is the biological equivalent of stamp collecting, and that, you know, paleontologists have nothing interesting to say to biologists. But I think there's more to it, and something that I didn't get very deeply into in the book, because it's very difficult to document, is that, of course, the late 1960s and 1970s are, you know, an era of rebellion and revolution, you know, politically and socially. And some of these people, Stephen Jay Gould in particular, you know, were very much part of that that culture of rebellion. So I think that, you know, the 1960s and 70s, it was a good time to be pushing back against what, you know, the old graybeards had, you know, had to say. And so I think for somebody like Gould, you know, I think he would have been a rebel in whatever field he was in. Mm-hmm. That was part of his temperament. And he happened to be a paleontologist. And so, you know, his entire career was spent kind of campaigning against orthodoxy in a variety of forms, unlike somebody like Dave Rout, who I think, you know, didn't see what he was doing as part of any kind of broader social or political movement. I think Gould very much did see what he was doing as, you know, the work in paleontology as connected to broader, you know, protest, broader cultural protest and rebellion in politics and culture. But, you know, to get back to the question you asked, what were they rebelling against? I mean, specifically, it was this notion that paleontology is, really just a subfield of geology, that it didn't have anything relevant to say to biology, and that, the evidence that paleontologists were working with wasn't relevant to, the really exciting fields in biology, like population genetics and eventually molecular biology.
Okay. So that, I mean, I can tell us about the revolt against what biologists think of paleontology. How do paleontologists feel about the established community sort of in the 50s and 60s? How do they feel about this desire to incorporate all of these mathematical techniques and the desire to incorporate evolutionary theory, I guess, into paleontology?
Sure, yeah, and that's a great question. Because, of course, people like Gould were not just rebelling against biology; they were also rebelling against paleontologists. So, the paleobiology movement did certainly in the 1970s very much have a kind of, you know, us against the world mentality, because it's a small group of people who are not only questioning the status of paleontology within evolutionary biology, but they're also trying to change in some ways the definition of what paleontology was, and this did not sit very well with a lot of more traditional paleontologists who really thought that what a paleontologist did was, you know, dig up and describe fossil organisms, write, you know, monographs about a particular, you know, taxonomic group, and maybe at the end of a very long career say something slightly more general about the history of life, but not make large-scale pronouncements about the tempo and mode of evolution. So, yeah, the paleobiologists certainly by the 1970s were kind of getting it from both directions. They were getting resistance from biologists, and they were getting resistance from other paleontologists. And I think that certainly heightened the sense for people like Gould that what they were doing was radical and rebellious.
Okay. So instead of just being doing descriptive biology and stratigraphy, and then making, when you're the president of the society, making a few remarks about biology, you're going to do something a bit more dramatic.
I mean, Gould's first paper, first published paper from 1960, now I can't remember exactly what the date was, I want to say 1967, but it might have been earlier, was titled, "Is Uniformitarianism Necessary?" You know, and of course, uniformitarianism, the idea that, you know, we understand geological processes as being slow and continuous, and this is Charles Lyell's big contribution from the 19th century. You know, that's the heart of of, you know, what every paleontologist learned in their training. And here's Gould as a graduate student writing a paper saying, you know, maybe that's the wrong way to think about geology. And, you know, that certainly set the tone for, you know, for what was to come.
You go straight for the bedrock, to make a really bad metaphor.
And there's a, I mean, there's a passage that I actually quote in the book, from an interview I did with Niles Eldridge, who was coming up with Gould at Columbia, in the late 1960s. And he says, you know, what Gould taught him as a graduate student was, you don't wait until you're an old man to make your important contributions. You know, that the young should be kind of, you know, seizing the profession. And that's precisely what these folks did.
Okay. So one of the, I mean, they're very canny about their revolt and seizing the profession. And one of the things that they do and that they think about sort of very seriously is kind of building institutions for this new paleobiology, right? And these include things like monographs, but also conferences and a journal and a society, I think. So how did that work out, and were they, how successful were they?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that I argue in the book is that within this small group of people that were really kind of the heart of the paleobiological movement in the 1970s and 1980s, different people had different fairly specific roles. So Raup was the guy who was kind of coming up with the radical ideas. Gould was the guy who was doing the propaganda, who was, you know, writing both professional and popular articles and books that were making the case for paleobiology. And then someone that most people outside of paleontology won't probably be very familiar with, Thomas J.M. Schopf, who was a paleontologist at the University of Chicago, was really the guy that took the institutional approach. He was the one who instigated for the founding of the journal Paleobiology in 1975. He was really working behind the scenes and doing a lot of the grunt work that's necessary for any movement to have a platform from which it can project itself. And what I argue is that, you know, these activities are very coordinated. Raup and Schopf and Gould are friends and close colleagues. They're having meetings, informal meetings. They're in correspondence all the time, you know, kind of coordinating these different elements of, you know, what one could describe as this paleobiological revolution. And I think that it was very clear to all of them right from the start that the institutional side of things was going to be vitally important, that ideas aren't enough. You need to have places to publish. You need to be able to train students. You need to be able to get jobs, you know, for your students once they've finished. And so I think that this movement wouldn't have had the success that it did have without this institutional agenda. And Tom Schopf without Tom Schopf, the movement wouldn't have had that success, because he is the one who really pushed the institutional agenda most vigorously.
And so there wasn't a sort of broad disagreement. They're quite unified about what the agenda should be and how to go about doing it.
Yeah, there was internal disagreement over certainly many kind of intellectual matters, but there was a shared common commitment to this central platform, which was that, you know, A, paleontology is biology. Mm-hmm. B, the history of life the fossil record is a vital body of empirical data for the understanding of evolution. See that quantitative, mathematical techniques are the way to understand this history of life. And then, that techniques like modeling and simulation that take us, away from just the empirical fossil record are important tools. So, on those four points, I think that the instigators of this paleobiological movement, and there are other people had group, certainly Steve Stanley, and Niles Eldridge, whom I mentioned, James Valentine, important paleoecologist, but those three people, Raup, Schopf, and Gould, I think were deeply committed on those four points. Now, of course, they did disagree on many particulars, and many of those disagreements were very, very interesting, and I document a lot of those in the second half.
And as an exercise in institution building, it's pretty successful. Is paleobiology, that's the journal they found, is it successful because they get paleontologists to read it or biologists to read it? Or I guess who is the audience for this new field?
Well, right from the get-go, the idea was that this would be a journal that would be both read and contributed to by paleontologists and biologists. So the initial editorial board was composed of biologists as well as paleontologists. Schopf made a real effort. Schopf was the founding editor. Made a real effort to recruit biologists to publish papers in the first several issues of the journal. Always used biologists as reviewers of papers alongside paleontologists, and this was I would say pretty successful. I don't think that every evolutionary biologist subscribe to or reads paleobiology, but certainly more biologists read it than were reading more traditional journals like the Journal of Paleontology or the Journal Paleontology, which is published in Britain. So it was successful there, but I would say that it was probably more successful in attracting a readership of paleontologists who were drawn to this new paleobiological approach. So, it became a kind of focal point for paleontologists who maybe had been feeling, dissatisfied with the traditional approach to paleontology, and provided a venue for those people and a kind of a community. People with shared interests.
Okay, so for paleologists that wanted to do more than descriptive taxonomies and that sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to the ideas, because, institutions are important, but there's also a number of, ideas that are immediately associated with paleobiology, and I guess the most significant one, or the most famous one, is this idea of punctuated equilibrium.
Right.
What is the idea, not what is the exact idea, but where did the ideas come from, how were they adapted and developed?
Sure. And of course, I'll just say very briefly for anybody who might be listening who isn't familiar with the theory. The theory of punctuated equilibrium, it's presented in both forms. Is a theory that says that the history of life is not always the slow, continuous development that Darwin had proposed. That in fact, certain lineages go through long periods where they don't change very much, stasis, can be many millions of years, punctuated by very short bursts of evolutionary change. And so what you get is a more jerky picture of evolution. And indeed, one of the epithets that was thrown against Gould and Eldridge by an opponent of punctuated equilibrium is that the theory is evolution by jerks. And of course, there was a double entendre there. After saying that, I sort of forgot the first part of the question. It was what made it so important? Is that
not so much what made it more, but I guess where do the ideas come from? And then, they're just ideas sitting in, Eldridge's dissertation, right? And then they get magnified into this kind of discipline defining idea.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the ideas behind punctuated equilibria were around for a long time. I mean, you can even trace back to Darwin ideas about rapid change, rapid speciation. Certainly Ernst Mayr, when he presented theory of allopatric speciation, peripheral isolation as being central in the evolution of new species. Essentially, the idea is that if you get a small population isolated because of population genetics, there will be faster genetic change in that population, and that most cases of speciation will take place amongst these small peripherally isolated populations. I mean, that was an idea from the 1940s, and all Eldredge was really trying to do in his dissertation, which was on Devonian trilobites, was apply what he called sort of the dominant biological model of speciation to the fossil record, and show that indeed what the fossil record tells us is that speciation tends to take place fairly rapidly in isolated populations. He didn't present this in any way as a new theory or any kind of revolutionary revision of evolutionary thought. But somehow, when Eldredge and Gould got together a couple of years after Eldredge finished his dissertation and wrote their first paper on punctuated equilibria, this idea got translated, mostly thanks to Gould, into a revolutionary new approach to understanding the history of life. And so, I mean, talking about the history of that theory, punctuated equilibria, is complicated, because in one version, it's a fairly straightforward reading of what population biologists had been saying for quite a long time. In another reading, it's this radical new theory of the history of life. And even the authors themselves, Gould and Eldredge, were never very consistent in terms of, sometimes it was being presented as, you know, this is just what we've known for a long time, what's the big deal? And sometimes it was, this new radical idea that is going to change the way we think about evolution.
Okay. So it's really, I mean, Gould's contribution is this master of rhetoric that builds on things and can project them outwards, I guess, right?
Sure, and I think that, you know, what happened, I spend an entire chapter on punctuated equilibria in the book, in part because that's exactly what I want to show. I want to show how Gould and kind of bends it to the agenda of paleobiology that he is in the process in 1972, really trying to launch out into the world.
Okay. So by the sort of mid-70s, you've got, I think, what is convincingly sort of a discipline that's coherent, that's people that are talking to each other, that are doing something new, that's applying all these mathematical models to the fossil record. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you argue and show is that there's actually quite a few different ways of rereading the fossil record. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that I think people get the most excited about, or is perhaps the most ambitious, is what you call the nomothetic approach to paleontology. What is it, and what's at stake in it, and I guess?
Sure. Yeah, well, this division between so-called nomothetic and ideographic science is something that goes back to the 19th century. It's a German idea. And basically, the idea is that nomothetic science is science that is geared towards producing laws. And ideographic science is science that basically just kind of documents empirical cases. And Gould latched onto this. I think he liked anything that sounded, fancy and German, or had Latinate, terms or something like that. But he latched onto this idea that what paleobiology really needed to be doing was producing, laws, was making generalized, lawful statements about the history of life. And so he starts pushing this idea early on in the 1970s. And, it gets interpreted in a variety of ways. I mean, I think one early way that it gets interpreted is that, nomothetic paleontology will be paleontology that does not deal with specific cases. Does not look at a particular slice of the fossil record and try to determine some generalities from that empirical evidence, but rather which will make, broad claims, perhaps in the form of equations or simulations about the history of life that are in some way idealizations of the way, you know, kind of the messy fossil record actually works. So here they're really taking a page out of the theoretical ecology movement that produced the theory of island biogeography and the work of people like E.O. Wilson and MacArthur and Hutchinson, who were ecologists who developed this kind of mathematical modeling heuristic approach to the study of living populations. And so I think for Gould and for Schopf and to some degree Raup in the 1970s, nomothetic paleontology was paleontology that was applying this kind of heuristic approach. We're using models as a kind of a way of developing general insights into the history of life that may be oversimplifications or idealizations of what the empirical record tells us, but which kind of can stand as, if not laws, at least very broad generalizations. And so that really is very much the agenda of paleobiology as Gould and Schopf and Raup are pushing it in the 1970s, although it does change then in the 1980s.
Right. And I guess there's different, I mean, I guess can you tease out, I mean, how is it exactly, is it going to be heuristic, and what is the relationship exactly to the fossil record?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, in terms of it, you know, a heuristic model, I mean, you can think about in ecology, take something like the species area law, which just tells us how many species we expect to find in a particular area. Now, that's something that's based certainly on some empirical documentation, but you know, it's an equation, sort of like, you know, an equation of physics that tells us something about, in a general case, how all populations should look. And paleobiologists were looking for something similar. What Tom Schopf was really, keen on was developing what he called gas laws of paleontology. So, you know, the gas laws tell us something about the density of particles of in a volume of gas. And, you know, it's a simple equation. And really literally thought perhaps we could have simple equations that would tell us some dynamics of evolution change. And this was very much connected to a project that Schopf and Gould and Raup and eventually were working in the 1970s, which was to use computers to simulate in a very idealized way evolutionary lineages to essentially simulate evolution and generate, using random generators, branching lineages, and then step back and take a look at the sorts of patterns that were being produced, and then compare those to the actual patterns in the fossil record as a way of testing certain hypotheses about patterns.
Right. And one of the hypotheses that's relevant here is just about the randomness of evolution and extinction, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So the main hypothesis that this so-called called the stochastic simulation program was trying to do was to test whether, in fact, we could potentially understand the branching processes, the branching patterns that we see in the fossil record as being produced purely randomly and not through, well, I guess not through the normal kinds of selective pressures that biologists normally associate evolution and, you know, periods of speciation and extinction with. So in some ways, this was a, you know, very radical kind of hypothesis. And, you know, all they really were trying to argue is that could argue for, you know, randomness as a more prominent in evolution, not specifically in particular cases we had to assume that evolution was random. They certainly weren't trying to get rid of natural selection, certainly weren't trying to get rid of adaptation. They were simply saying, let's not ignore the factors in evolution that might turn out to be important. important in some cases.
Right. And that continues to be something that they say to evolutionary biologists. One of the things that also comes out of the book is that how timely and time-sensitive, I guess, the development of paleobiology was because of its dependence on computation and increased computational capacity, I guess. So it's not just simulations that really that rely on computation, but the field. What else are people using, I guess, computers to be able to do?
Sure. Well, I mean, the other really major way that computers come into play are in terms of databases. So storing and then processing paleontological data. So people had been collecting lists of the various taxa, various taxonomic groups in the history of life for, you know, over 100 years in big books. And what computers allow you to do is to, you know, transfer that information to an electronic format that can be sorted and analyzed in all kinds of interesting ways. So in addition to doing things like, making pretty simulations of idealized shell forms or doing these simulations of randomly branching phylogenies, paleontologists by the mid-1970s start putting their data into computers and then also using the computers to perform statistical analyses that would be either very difficult and time-consuming or impossible without their aid.
Okay. When Gould famously refers to rerunning the tape of life, I mean, is it a computer tape that he's talking about?
That's something that I've often I've long thought was maybe the case. It's a pity that I started this project. It's a pity that he died young for a variety of reasons. But personally, there are a lot of questions I would have liked to have asked him, and that's one of them. Because of course, an audio tape doesn't make any sense. Because if you rewind an audio tape, it always plays the same thing. Right. So I tend to think that he did have in mind a computer tape, because the mainframes that they were using in those days were using magnetic tape storage. And I'm thinking, this metaphor first starts popping up around 1976, 1977. I'm thinking that he's thinking about a computer program that gets rerun on tape. But, that's unfortunately, unless there's a letter somewhere in Gould's archive, which has now finally just been opened at Stanford University, unless there's a letter in there, that's, I think, something that's never going to be definitively settled.
Okay. And it's the tapes, those tapes in particular about running these sort of simulations that rely on random patterning, right?
Yeah. Exactly. I think that the metaphor comes up directly in the context of this random simulation work that they're doing. And I think that's exactly what he's thinking. I think he's thinking that, we rerun this program, and every time we rerun it, we get a different result. I think that that's precisely the metaphor that he's drawing on initially when he presents that.
Okay. So the other big idea that you think comes out of paleontology and that speaks to evolutionary biology relates to hierarchy and ideas about macroevolution.
Mm-hmm.
And you also talk there. I mean, there's a famous evolutionary biology that sort of welcomes paleobiologists back to the high table of the evolutionary synthesis. So what is it that paleobiologists are bringing to this high table?
Sure. So by the early 1980s, paleobiologists are starting to see some success in their movement. And one of the kind of most visible tokens of that success is this statement that John Maynard Smith, famous British geneticist, makes in 1984 in the journal Nature, in a little opinion piece that he writes titled "Paleontology at the High Table." And at the end of this essay, he makes the comment, paleontologists have too long been missing from the high table of evolutionary theory. Welcome back. That passage has been selectively quoted many times by paleontologists, and it seems to indicate sort of a dramatic success. The high table metaphor, of course, is a very British metaphor. It's a metaphor from, the colleges in Cambridge and Oxford where, the students all sit in the hall and the fellows and the faculty sit up at a raised table on a raised platform at the end of the hall. And so the idea is, of course, now paleontology is getting to join the big boys. Certainly Maynard Smith's statement does indicate that, biologists are beginning to accept certain ideas in paleontology. And the two ideas that he's directly referring to are these new ideas about hierarchy in macroevolution, and also to new paleontological theories that are centered around extinction, and particularly mass extinction. And so I argue at the end of the book that kind of the two crucial successes are macroevolution and extinction theory, and in some ways these two ideas are joined. The macroevolutionary synthesis that people like Gould, but also Steve Stanley and Niles Eldridge and others are trying to push, basically presents the traditional Darwinian understanding of evolution through natural selection as being only one component or one level of a broader hierarchical understanding of evolutionary processes that extends from the level of the gene all the way up to the level of the higher taxonomic categories, like the family. And the argument is that we can't use the same, we can't understand the same mechanisms necessarily as operating at every single level of hierarchy. So what you get is, at the population level is natural selection, just as Darwin and then the population geneticists who contributed to the modern synthesis proposed. But when you get up to the higher taxonomic levels, you get other kinds of processes, things like species selection, where entire taxonomic groups can have properties that contribute to their overall success or failure on the evolutionary playing field that are different, in some ways disconnected, or as Steve Stanley somewhat famously said, decoupled from the lower hierarchical processes. And so it's a kind of controversial idea. It certainly gets a lot of attention in the early 1980s, but the biologists, the geneticists, even people like John Maynard Smith are constantly saying, show us how this works, mm-hmm. how with genetics, we can understand entities like species or higher taxonomic categories as having, as being vehicles for selection. It's something that geneticists have a lot of trouble with. So I would say that macroevolution is very important in terms of attracting attention to paleontology, but it's also controversial. I think that the less controversial kind of success story that paleontology had was with extinction. And I think that that's really what Maynard Smith has more in mind in the statement that he makes in 1984, which is that paleontologists really fairly definitively demonstrated that we cannot leave extinction out of our understanding of evolution, that extinctions, and particularly mass extinctions, where, large numbers of species, genera, even families, disappear in a kind of geological blink of an eye. These things have happened in the history. They have had a profound impact on the development of evolution by removing certain groups in one swipe of the brush, or changing the ecological and evolutionary landscape and the selective regimes that have existed. So it's really extinction, I think, that is. What finally gets paleontology taken seriously to the extent that it is taken seriously by evolutionary biologists.
Okay. We've taken up a lot of your time, but why don't you tell us how you're going to continue being a historian of paleontology? What are you working on now?
Projects. I'm writing a book on extinction, actually, where I'm really trying to do is take a look at the relationship between biology ideas about extinction from the mid-19th century up to the present day, the relationship between those biological ideas and cultural values that surround extinction and endangerment and diversity. So I'm trying to look at the ways that the biologists have influenced how we think about the kind of diversity of the biological world through their discussions of extinction, and how particular cultural values at particular times have influenced what biologists have said about extinction. So in the 19th century, I argue there was a lack of real appreciation or concern for what we now call biodiversity, which is a major concern. And one of my arguments is that what changes is our understanding of extinction. So that's a book that I'll be writing over the next couple of years, hopefully a bit shorter than this last book that I wrote, and aimed at a bit of a broader audience than the book that I just wrote. And then another project is collaborative project at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, where I work on the history of data and databases. So we have a big project where we're trying to historicize how data and databases became so important in a variety of sciences. And my angle on that is looking at the development of data collection, storage, and analysis in natural history disciplines like paleontology.
Okay, thanks so much, David. That was my conversation with David Sepkoski about his new book, Rereading the Fossil Record, The Growth of Paleobiology as an Evolutionary Discipline. For the New Book Network's page for Science, Technology, and Society, I'm Patrick Slaney. Thanks.